This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and on today's show, Anne Cleaves tells us about writing 30 books over 30 years.
I think one of the skills of a good writer is to leave enough space within the words for the readers to bring their own imagination, their own creativity.
I chat to Monty Dawn about his book, The Road to Latona Lee, and get some tips from both him and blind gardener Kevin Smith.
It doesn't matter whether you're fully sighted or totally blind or partially sighted or whatever, not to embrace all the possibilities of your senses. It's crazy.
I review A Chronicle of Ancient Darkness, and Frank Cottrell Boyce explores the books of his life.
It's an amazing book, and it's a book in which it's about magic. It's about a school for wizards, in fact.
That's all coming up on today's show. But first, let's head to New York to hear about an award for the RNIB Talking Books Service. Here's Alan Russell with more.
Congratulations are in order. Why? Well, because Talking Books has won an award at a very prestigious New York awards ceremony. To tell us more, we have with us all the way from New York. Yes, he's there. Rupert Morgan was out there picking up the award. Rupert, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. That's very kind. Congratulations mainly should go to RNIB Cymru, though. Helith Roberts and Emma Jones. The book was narrated by an actress called Hannah Jarman. And so in many ways, it's her award too, but it's all about the production. It's all about the teamwork. And so, you know, it's very much RNIB's award and Hannah's too.
So it's the New York Radio Festival Award, and you've picked this up for the book. Tell us a bit more about the book.
Well, the book is actually a Welsh translation of David Walliams's Gangster Granny. So if anybody's got children of the right age to know the book, then you'll know what it's about. The anarchic fun that is David Walliams. But obviously, in this instance, it's the Welsh translation.
Great that a book has been recognised for a translation into, not just into an audiobook, but into Welsh language as well, and such an international award too.
Yeah, really exciting that the award has gone to a Welsh language title. That's such a positive thing, because obviously we need to encourage more and more publishers to look at making books not just accessible, but accessible in the other languages within the UK as well. Hopefully this success will go some way to playing a part in that.
So two awards already in the bag, but this one, as you say, for a Welsh language book, which again is great news and great testimony as well to the quality of work that goes into doing something like this.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think that's very much the point that we're always trying to get across, is that RNIB Talking Books, be they in the Welsh language, we always take as professional approach as we possibly can. Every book is given the love and the attention that it deserves. It just so happens that this particular one's won an award, but everything we do, we try to do to the best quality possible. We want to get that sense of professionalism throughout all of our recordings.
What was it like at the ceremony then, Rupert, you know, getting the nomination, hearing about the award and actually collecting it?
Well, it was, as you would rather expect, it was a lovely evening. Penthouse apartment of the Manhattan building at 85th Avenue, with an incredible view across the city. If anyone knows New York, it's sort of down at the Madison end of town. Lovely people from all nationalities. There were people there from Serbia and Croatia and Argentina and Australia, as well as many Brits and Americans picking up awards. There was somewhat of a running theme about blind and partially sighted issues going on. An Argentinian documentary maker who'd made a very interesting sounding, although admittedly all in Spanish, recording about a blind man describing his experiences of what it was like, what it's been like to grow up in Buenos Aires.
So you made your speech, you picked up the award, but thank you for taking the time to speak to us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much, Alan. Take care.
From RNIB, the UK's leading sight loss charity, this is RNIB Connect Radio.
Hannah Jarman is the narrator of David Walliams's Cyfrinach Nana Crooker, Gangster Granny, and I began by offering my congratulations.
It's fantastic news. I can't believe it. I just think it's brilliant, especially for a Welsh language book, to have this kind of fuss made about it. I think it's so important, and it's something that you think that maybe doesn't get the attention it deserves. So I'm absolutely thrilled, yeah. My relationship with audiobooks actually comes from when my sister was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease when she was 10 years old. So big print books, of course, from RNIB then went on to audiobooks. So I've always been aware of the Daisy machine and her having access to the books, sending them back and receiving them through the post. And as I started doing voice work like cartoons for S4C, I wanted to originally volunteer to do audiobooks, and then they were looking for actors to get involved. So yeah, that's how I started. I do mostly children's books, and I think that is something that's really close to me, because if Mared, my sister, hadn't had access to those, a difficult process would have been even more difficult for her to overcome those things, especially as a child who loved reading. And I just think it's such an important service, I mean, for us to have access to audiobooks. The fact that the big titles and the books that are really popular now, currently, should be accessible to visually impaired children. I'm employed as an actor to do the book. So the producer emails me with, would you like to do this book? So I've done some David Walliams children's books in Welsh language and Roald Dahl. And then I receive the book through the post. I have a read of the book. And with children's books, obviously, there's like lots of voices and big characters. So I'll go through that. And then we'll sit in the studio then in Cardiff and go through it.
Gwibiodd y ddau drwy'r dref. Nana Crwca oedd yn gyrru a Ben yn cydio'n dyn amdani. Roedd y ddau'n gwisgo dillad a masgau deifio sgwba. Roedd Hew wrth i'n cael y siop ar ddiwedd y dydd. Helo, Hew! Cofia gadw losi mintys i mi ar dydd Llun, gweuddodd yr hen raig. Edrychodd Hew yn gegrwth ar y ddau. O, ni ddim be sy'n bod yno fo. Mae'n siaradus iawn fel arfer, meddai Nana Crwca. Roedd Llundain yn bell. A doedd y sgwter ddim yn gallu mynd yn gyflym iawn, yn enwedig wrth gario Ben a'i nain.
Between acting jobs, I work in schools and do workshop with children. Yeah, so I'm very familiar with how important that storytelling is to children. And they use their imaginations a lot more than, you know, adults. So it's really important for them to have that distinct voice, I think. And it really paints the character vividly. I really like how he turns sort of male and female stereotypes on their head. You know, there's the grandmother is a gangster granny. The boy is he wants to wear a dress, and why not wear a dress? I really like that he challenges those sort of things that we project onto children. I think that, you know, men and women must behave this way. I'm absolutely thrilled. It's just never something that I thought would get recognised. It's more for, selfishly, for me to feel good about doing something like this. So it's to be acknowledged by a bigger board is brilliant. I'm really thrilled for the RNIB.
Narrator of David Walliams is Cyfrinach Nana Crwca, Gangster Granny, Hannah Jarman. Emma Jones, transcription manager for RNIB Cymru, received exciting news overnight.
So we knew up until yesterday that we'd been shortlisted as a finalist in the category Best Solo Narration. And we've heard overnight that we've actually won a bronze trophy, which is hugely exciting for us. So we contribute about 30 Welsh language titles to our Talking Book Library each year, and we were invited to submit an entry to the competition. So I set about listening to several of our Welsh language talking books that we produced over the last year and listened to what I thought was a really funny, engaging piece from Cyfrinach Nana Crwca, which is Gangster Granny by David Walliams in Welsh, and put that forward as an entry. Talking books are hugely important. It's so important that blind and partially sighted children can listen to contemporary books and discuss them with their peers so they can talk with their friends about what their friends are reading as well. And RNIB has made a commitment that we'll prioritise the delivery and the promotion of the Welsh language. It's underpinned by legislation, but more importantly than that, we actually believe that the option to use Welsh when reading for blind and partially sighted people in Wales is a fundamental right. we look at the books that have been published in recent months and try and really choose a broad selection of titles that we think will appeal to as many people as possible. So we try and include some really engaging children's books like Cyfrinach Nana Crooker, but also books that perhaps have won literary prizes during the year, and try and get a real range of titles to make sure that there's something for everybody. So we have a pool of narrators that we can call upon, all with a background in acting or broadcasting, so some professional experience to make sure that the books that we produce are really of the highest quality. And Hannah is one of the narrators in our narrator pool. When we look to cast a book, we'll look at the book, we'll look at dialect, we'll look at obviously whether it would be better for a male or female reader, and try and cast thinking about the voice of the narrator and how that might come across, and, you know, characterisation. There are all sorts of aspects to the decision.
Emma Jones, RNIB Cymru Transcription Manager. For more information on talking books, visit the website rnib.org.uk/talking books.
Congratulations to all. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Frank Cottrell Boyce will be coming up later, and Claire Carson will be chatting to Anne Cleaves after this.
Almost 2 million people in the UK are living with sight loss.
Author Sarah Waters on supporting Talking Books.
When you lose your sight, it's easy to feel like you've lost everything. Reading unlocks virtually everything we do in life. Not being able to read means you lose the ability to read for necessity and for pleasure. RNIB's Talking Books helps people find their lives again. Unfortunately, less than 5% of books are in a format accessible to blind and partially sighted people. It costs RNIB £4 million a year to run the Talking Books service. This wouldn't be possible without your help. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
Crime writer Anne Cleaves, who wrote the books behind the TV detective series Shetland and Vera, has written 30 books in 30 years. Well, to celebrate this fact, she undertook a tour recently giving talks about her work and her latest book, Cold Earth, at 30 different locations around the UK. Luckily enough, one of those locations was in Peterborough, where our Talking Books library is located. Well, I went along to hear her speech before interviewing her.
Without further ado, a very, very warm welcome to Anne. Thank you. If you'd told me 30 years ago that I would end up with 30 books, two series on the television, Vera on ITV and Shetland on the BBC, I don't think I would have believed you. And I would love to think that that success is down to my innate genius. Absolutely not. It's mostly down to luck. And I thought that today I'd talk about some of those pieces of luck that led to me ending up where I am now.
Anne had the audience at Peterborough Library spellbound as she told her own story and the stories of her characters. I spoke to her after her speech and asked her about the inspiration for her latest novel, Cold Earth.
Cold Earth is one of the Shetland books. It's number 7 of the Shetland books. And it starts with a landslide, which becomes a kind of metaphor throughout the book, I think, of one sudden dramatic event changing, fracturing communities and changing people's lives. And that's what I like writing about. So that's how it starts. You want me to read a little bit from the beginning?
Perfect.
Right, so yes, this is after the landslide has hit. Jimmy Perez is going to have a look at a croft that's been hit by the landslide. "We should join them, Jimmy," Kevin Hayes said. "Nothing we can do here." In the distance, they heard the sound of sirens. He looked back at the hill, worried about another landslide. "You go, I need to stay anyway." Perez looked beyond the house. There'd been a lean-to shed on the back of the kitchen, and that had been completely destroyed. Glass and the corrugated iron roof would have been swept into the mud. Beyond it, though, a stone wall that separated the small garden from the open grazing beyond was almost undamaged. It seemed to have funneled the landslip through a gap where a wooden gate had once been. Nearest the space, the edges of the wall were ragged, eaten away like unravelled knitting. But beyond the gap on each side, they were quite solid. The tide of earth had deposited debris there, thrown it up on its way through. Perez saw a bedhead, a couple of plastic garden chairs that must have been stored in the lean-to. And something else, bright against the grey wall and the black soil, a splash of red, brighter than blood. He scrambled down the bank towards it. A woman's body had been left behind by the ebbing tide of earth. She wore a red silk dress, exotic, glamorous. Not the thing for a February day in Shetland, even if she'd been indoors when the landslide swept her away. Her hair and her eyes were black, and Perez felt a strange, atavistic connection. She could be Spanish like his ancestors of centuries ago. Kevin Hay was already walking back to the cars, and Perez stood alone with her, waiting until the emergency services arrived.
Perfect. Tell us about the characters, because we've got the detective, Jimmy Perez, and
the love interest. Yes, we've got Willow, who I'm getting more and more fond of. She's the inspector who takes over as in charge of the case from the mainland. And she's quite an interesting character because she grew up in a commune in North Uist. So she's a Scottish Islander as well, but the Uists are very, very different from Shetland. And her act of rebellion was to come out of the commune and join the police force. So she's got wild hair and does yoga every morning before breakfast. And Jimmy's not quite sure what to make of her. But there is a relationship that develops throughout this book, which I'm very pleased with. It's about time he found a bit of happiness, I think.
Because he's a single parent.
He is a single parent, and that was quite fun to write. And his daughter isn't his biological child. He's her stepfather. It was really, really fun to write that. Yes, that relationship about a single man looking after a child who's not his.
I love the humanity through the book. We talk about Willow, the fact that she loves drinking coffee because her parents drank herbal tea. Mm-hmm. How Jimmy is so caught between the need to go to the school to catch the teacher for a particular reason, but yet he feels he should be staying with a boy to talk to him. It's very, very human, rooted in the decisions that we make every day, and yet there's this fantastical crime going on around it.
I hope so. I think that's what I enjoy writing about. The great thing about classic detective stories is that really you don't need to worry about the plot because the plot is a given. You have a body in the first couple of chapters and you have a limited number of suspects and you have a resolution. So after that, that frees you up to write the sort of books that you really like writing. An American reviewer said that I write village noir, and I really like that because I'm not just writing about families or individuals, I'm writing about communities. And I do like that sense of the fact that we do need to live in community with other people, and that sense of selflessness that you need to live in a successful community. I'm quite interested in writing about all that.
And is that part of your own upbringing, this sense of community?
I think it is, but I think I found it especially in Shetland. I first went to Shetland more than 40 years ago. I dropped out of university and got a job as assistant cook in the Bird Observatory in Fair Isle. And Fair Isle is a very unique community, and it's a community that works beautifully because people know that they have to work together. Even if you don't particularly get on with your neighbour, the only way that island is going to run and thrive is if people work together. We need people. They need people to work on the roads, to be up at the airstrip when the planes come in, to man the fire tender. And without that sort of community involvement, the island wouldn't still exist.
When you started to have the idea for setting a series of crime novels in Shetland, did you really think it would be this successful? Because it's now the full-blown television series.
Not at all. I think it was supposed to be a standalone novel originally, Raven Black. My editor thought it would stretch credibility too far to have more than one murder story set in a community of 22,000 people. I think readers are very forgiving and they're quite happy to to give up that, you know, they'll suspend their disbelief for a little while because we've killed off, between us, the TV show and the books, many more people than that. But, I've just been very, very lucky, and I'm very lucky that the TV show is so well made too, I think.
Moving on to talking about how you write, are you a very disciplined writer? Do you get up and get on, or do you wait for the ideas, or how do you go about writing such successful books?
I don't really need to be disciplined because that's what I enjoy most, is making stuff up. So sitting at my kitchen table early in the morning, because I do start early, that's when my brain works best. That's the best thing. That's the great thing to be doing. What a privilege to be able to earn a living telling stories, which is what we all do. You know, kids do it from the minute they can talk. They're making stories up about themselves or other people or imaginary friends. And I just have a bigger cast of imaginary friends, I think, than other people.
And a lovely story of redemption at the end and a coming together somehow.
Yes, and I think that's why traditional crime fiction is so popular again. You know, we did have quite a dark, quite violent stories a few years ago with the fashion. That's what people were wanting to read. Now I think people do feel the need, because maybe we're living in a very uncertain times at the moment, they feel the need for some sort of resolution at the end of a book. And I think that's why more traditional crime fiction is a lot more popular now than it's been for years.
Now, written in such a pacey style that makes it a fantastic listen, are you aware that you're writing it for a listening audience as well as a one that's going to read the text?
I am, because I worked for a while in public libraries. I was a reader development officer in public libraries in West Yorkshire. And one of the favourite things that I did was work with the visually impaired persons reading group, the VIP group. And I just had such a good time with those readers. You know, we managed to raise a bit of funding and organise taxis to bring people in. And I do hope that that's still going, and I hope that other library authorities do something similar, because it was such an interesting conversation, because the conversations weren't just about the books, about the stories, but about the interpretation by the reader. So it gave a very different depth to somebody who wasn't used to audiobooks, to come across these people who were so sophisticated in their listening and had such interesting comments about not just the stories and the characters, but about the interpretation by the reader.
And also, if there are any tiny holes in the writing, which I'm sure there would never be in your... I mean, my goodness, it's going to be picked up by a readers group like that.
Yes, that's right. And what I think is that writers provide the framework, but reading, either through listening or reading on the page, is much more creative than people give it credit for. So we provide the framework, but the readers are the people who create the pictures in their heads. And I think one of the skills of a good writer is to leave enough space within the words for the readers to bring their own imagination, their own creativity, their own prejudice even, into the story. And that's why reading groups are so interesting, because no reader sees it or hears it in the same way. And that's why you have some people who are passionately fond of a book and other people who really can't stand it. And that makes for the most interesting discussions.
Thanks very much to Anne Cleeves. And Anne will be presented later this year with a crime writer's highest award, the Diamond Dagger, joining the ranks of other top crime writers such as John le Carré, Ian Rankin and Ruth Rendell. So congratulations to Anne for that. And there are lots of books by Anne Cleeves in our library. Here's a selection. Cold Earth, TB 23792, and coming soon in Braille and giant print. Thin Air, TB 22560, Braille and giant print. Dead Water, TB 21172, coming soon in Braille and giant print. The Crow Trap, TB 23145, Braille and giant print. For more information, go to www.rniblibrary.com.
Thanks to Claire Carson and to Anne Cleves. As Claire said, a wide selection of Anne's books is available in various accessible formats from the RNIB library. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. As you may remember, in a recent show, one of our younger listeners, Callum, gave me an educating Red suggestion.
The quest is to defeat the bear, which is actually possessed by a demon. So that's why it's acting so unnaturally. And it basically makes it super-powered. And they have a time limit. So when the Auroch moon, I'm pretty sure it's called, rises, that's when demons are strongest. They will become unstoppable.
Well, I have a long journey ahead of me next weekend, so I shall take Wolf Brother by Michelle Paver, is it?
Yes, Michelle Paver.
I shall take a copy of that with me on my iPod, and I shall look forward to listening to it.
Well, that was a couple of weeks ago, and true to my word, I went to the RNIB library and borrowed the first book in the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness series by Michelle Paver, Wolf Brother. As Torak's father lies dying, having been savaged by a demon bear, he makes his 12-year-old son swear an oath. He must find the sacred mountain before the bear becomes all-powerful, otherwise the forest and all who live in it will perish. Torak has grown up in the forest, but far from the other clans of Stone Age people, each of which have adopted a different animal as their clan guardian. Torak belongs to the wolf clan, and as he flees the homicidal bear, he adopts an orphaned wolf cub as his companion. Alone, injured and terrified, they must fend for themselves and live off the land, as they journey north to fulfil Torak's quest.
He sat down again. "You've got to find the Mountain of the World Spirit within the next moon," he told himself. "That's what Far said. When the red eye is highest, that's when demons are strongest. You know this." "Yes, I do know it," thought Torak. "I know about the red eye. I've seen it." Every autumn, the great bull Auroch, the most powerful demon in the other world, escapes into the night sky. At first, he has his head down, pawing the earth, so that only the starry gleam of his shoulder can be seen. But as winter comes on, he rises and grows stronger. That's when you see his glittering horns and his bloodshot red eye, the red star of winter. And in the moon of Red Willow, he rides highest and evil is strongest. That's when the demons walk. That's when the bear will be invincible. Glancing up through the branches, Torak saw the cold glint of stars. On the eastern horizon, just above the distant blackness of the high mountains, he found it. The starry shoulder of the great Auroch. It was now the end of the moon of roaring stags. In the next moon, the Blackthorn moon, the red eye would appear, and the power of the bear would grow stronger. By the moon of Red Willow, it would be invincible. "Head north," Far had said. "Many day walks." Torak didn't want to go further north. That would take him out of the small patch of the forest that he knew and into the unknown. And yet, Far must have believed that he stood a chance or he wouldn't have made him swear.
The boy and the wolf are able to communicate with each other, and Wolf acts as Torak's guide through a forest devastated by the marauding bear. But they're captured by the Raven clan. A meeting of the clans is called, at which Torak discovers that his destiny is not his own. His father told him nothing about the events surrounding his birth or of the prophecy of the listener. As the clans debate whether to sacrifice Torak to the demon bear, time is running out. The phase of the moon when the demon bear will become invincible is approaching fast. Only Torak, aided by Wolf and a young female hunter named Wren, can save the forest and its inhabitants from annihilation. Wolf Brother was something of a first for me. I can't remember ever having read a book that was set 6,000 years ago. It's a mark of just how well written and researched it is that I found myself gripped by the plot from the outset. It throws the reader straight into the action. The skills required of the hunter-gatherer and the way primitive man made and used tools and coexisted with the natural world around him is deftly woven into the storyline. It's a great mix of action-packed entertainment and fact-filled anthropology.
It took Torak 2 full days to butcher the carcass. He had made the buck a promise, and he had to keep it by not wasting a thing. That was the age-old pact between the hunters and the world spirit. Hunters must treat prey with respect, and, in return, the spirit would send more prey. It was a daunting task. It takes many summers of practice to use prey well. Torak didn't make a very good job of it, but he did his best. First, he slit the deer's belly and cut a slip of the liver for the clan guardian. The rest of the liver he cut into strips and set to dry. Then he relented and cut off a bit for Wolf, who slurped it up. Next, Torak skinned the carcass, scraping the hide clean of flesh with his antler scraper. He washed the hide in water mixed with crumbled oak bark to loosen the hairs, then stretched it between 2 saplings, well out of Wolf's leaping range. Then he scraped off the hairs, inexpertly making several holes, and softened the hide by rubbing it with mashed deer brain. After a final round of soaking and drying, he had a reasonable skin of rawhide for rope and fishing lines. While the hide was drying, he cut the meat into thin strips and hung them over a smoky birchwood fire. When they were dry, he pounded them between 2 stones to make them thinner, then rolled them into small, tight bundles. The meat was delicious. One little piece would last him half a day. The innards he washed, soaked in oak bark water, and draped over a juniper bush to dry. The stomach would make a water skin, the bladder a spare tinder pouch, the guts would store nuts. The lungs were Wolf's share, although not yet. Torak would chew them at day meals and night meals, then spit them out for the cub. But as he had no cooking skin for making glue, he let Wolf have the hooves straight away. The cub played with them tirelessly before crunching them to bits.
This left me far more open to accept the fantasy elements of the tale. It's a world of magic and demons. The clans believed that all living things have souls that must be respected and appeased. Again, Paver's research and death storytelling make this seem perfectly natural, by showing just how closely the hunter-gatherers' lives are intertwined with their habitat. Also, though I've never been a great fan of books that feature animals with human characteristics, I found myself so caught up with the story that in this case it didn't bother me. By alternating between Torak's and Wolf's points of view, Paver highlights just how differently human and Wolf see the same events. Wolf very much has his own voice, which makes his character more three-dimensional, and underlines how precarious Torak's position as hero is. It also provides much of the book's humour, as when Wolf calls fire the bright beast that bites hot. If I'm wearing my cynical adult's hat, I'd have to admit that this is a very well-worn story in a new guise. It's Lord of the Rings or Star Wars set in the Stone Age. However, I'm not the target audience, and this is not a lazily written book. Anyone reading Wolf Brother will come away knowing a lot more about Stone Age man and hunter-gatherer tribes. And it's not just a book for boys. Wren is a practical and brave female counterpoint to Torak's adolescent male energy. So thanks, Callum, for a gripping, entertaining and very educative Educating Red suggestion. The version of Wolf Brother by Michelle Paver that I downloaded from the RNIB library is brilliantly read by David Thorpe and is TB14202. The version Callum loves, read by Sir Ian McKellen, is available commercially.
Thanks, Red. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. And later, Red will be back discussing books with Frank Cottrell Boyce. And I'll be getting my hands dirty with Monty Dawn after this.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com
or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Now, in the RNIB Talking Books library, you can go on a French garden odyssey with Monty Don's The Road to Laetona-Lay.
The weather south from Orange had been a growing revelation. This was 1973. Hardly anyone went abroad. My mother had never set foot in France, and my father went once in 1939 to kill Germans, and then almost get killed by them at Dunkirk. He never went back. Other than the weekend in Paris when I was 14, the furthest south I had been before was the Isle of Wight. Now it was autumn, yet the sun shone from a blue sky. People were tanned, wore dark glasses and smiled a lot. X was full of people my age sitting in street cafes drinking lager, citron pressé or real coffee. There were markets filled with vegetables I did not recognise, and crepe for sale on the street. By existing almost exclusively on bread and cheese, it was possible to live for just a few francs a day.
A clip from Monty Don's French garden odyssey, The Road to Laetona-Lay. It was read by Greg Wagland. I'll be joined later by a blind gardener to discuss all things sensory in the outdoors. But for the moment, Monty Don joined me on the line and told me about The Road to Laetona-Lay.
Well, I think the crucial thing is that it is not a book about French gardens. And this, it's bad to define things by what they're not, but it's, in this case, easier. It's a book about my experiences and relationship to France through the medium of its garden, and from the age of 14 up to nearly 60. So in other words, it's about my lifelong contact with France and its gardens. Admittedly quite sporadic, but it's a personal book. That's the point. It's not an objective study. The selection of gardens is entirely personal and erratic and arbitrary, and it's really trying to look at gardens from the perspective of a traveller, really, rather than the perspective of a horticulturist.
Is it frustrating to write about gardens rather than having a TV camera there and you can just say,
no, I much prefer it. I much prefer writing about gardens and talking about them on telly. Much more frustrating to do it on television. Because when you write about gardens, you can write about anything. You can make it as long or as short as you like. You can describe things that aren't happening in front of your eye. You can describe things that happened in 1662 and 1837 and yesterday and last autumn and next year. On telly, you can only show what there is to be seen. Mm-hmm. And also, you've probably got about 2 minutes to do it. Writing books is freedom. Writing books is me saying what I want to say. Television is the art of compromise. I mean, it's an interesting art and one that I love, but it's all television is about trying to cram at least a quart into a pint pot, and usually more like a whole great big milk container lorry into a pint pot. So in other words, you're always whittling down. And then you see, when it's filmed, about, up to three quarters of what we film will be chucked away. And at least a third will be chucked. And I have no control over what is thrown and what is kept. I'm not in the edit suite. Very often, what I consider to be my best work is never shown. because there might have been sound problems, or the images may not have quite worked, or it was just felt that it didn't quite fit in with other things. So that's the downside of filming. The upside is you're working as part of a team of experts who are very good at their jobs, and you are just one cog in that machine. Whereas a writer, you are the machine. It's you on your own. And a book like this one, I sat where I'm talking to you now in this room I wrote it very fast and very intensively because it had years of notes and I'd spent the whole year traveling. But it still took me about 12 weeks of doing nothing else at all from morning till night to do that. And if I hadn't had a family, I wouldn't have spoken to anyone else. I would have had no other contact. So writing is any book. It doesn't matter if it's the great novel or if it's a book about dog grooming. Is it lonely, solitary, repetitive work? And what makes it good is when it comes alive, when it becomes fantasy, when what's in your head goes onto the page.
Would you say that's the same as gardening? Could that be lonely and repetitive?
No, it's not. Gardening is very different. Gardening, you're working with nature. That's the whole thing. You're not trying to... It's a terrible mistake that people make about gardens, which is trying to create a garden and impose it onto the landscapes or onto the plot. Good gardens, all good gardens, are the synthesis of mankind's creativity and the natural world's bounty. And at their most successful, they harmonize, sometimes in surprising ways, but they work together always. And I think when you're writing, it's a blank page. It's absolutely what you put on the page. Television, as I say, is a machine, and it's a team. And when it's good, it's greater than the sum of its parts. But you're still, it's an artifact. You know, you still can fiddle around with it, and you can change things. Mm. Gardening is much more intuitive, much more responsive. It's a longer, slower, good gardening happens across years, lifetimes. Increasingly, I feel that happen across centuries, you know, that my garden is just a layer, a very thin skin on this earth. And when I go, someone else will add another thin layer. And so it builds up. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the garden, I'm connected to thousands of years of tending this soil. And that's a very enriching experience. And other times you're just dealing with one plant. It's very beautiful, mm-hmm. and you're looking after it. So I think gardening is creative, and I think it can be an art form, but it's very different to writing.
Now, I'm also joined on the line by blind gardener Kevin Smith. Now, Kevin, how did you get into blind gardening?
I always loved gardening. When I could see, I lost my sight 5 years ago, and when I could see, I always loved gardening, and I was a little bit lost for quite a while. I had the great good fortune to move in with Pocklington in Roehampton. And one of the care workers saw, you know, I was talking to him about how much I love gardening, and he found up a charity called Thrive, who work up in Battersea Park. Well, they're dotted about all over the place, but Battersea Park's where I went. I've now got a qualification in horticulture, and it's lovely. It's absolutely lovely.
Now, Kevin, why do you feel it's important to support Thrive and RNIB?
Well, I lost my sight very suddenly 5 years ago, and I've had so much help from people that I didn't know existed until I lost my sight. And they've supported me, even when I'm shouting and yelling at them, got the ump about life. It's all right, it's been okay, and they've listened and helped. And I think it's so important to put back. It's like, you know, when you're growing, you know, you've got to make sure the earth's right for the plant to grow in. And if I help dig the earth over and, I don't know, put fertiliser on it, then other plants can grow. And hopefully by being part of something, putting something back, somebody else gets some help as well. And they've been wonderful to me, absolutely wonderful.
Now, Kevin, I'm also joined on the line by Monty Dawn, and I believe you've got a question for him.
Yes, hello, Monty. Thanks for taking part. It's just really about how important do you think texture and sound and scent and the non-visual aspects of gardening are?
I think it's absolutely key. And I think in gardening, as in most things, that people with good sight tend to let that have much more dominance over their other senses. But years ago I wrote a book called The Sensuous Garden, which was all about using the different senses and how you can garden to make the most of them.
And I suppose after sight, the most obvious one is scent, because scent works on such a primeval way. It goes right to the oldest part of our brain. And as we know, scent and memory are inextricably linked, because you can't recognize smells except through memory. There's no way of knowing a smell except through an experience. So, for example, you smell an orange, and you will identify it as an orange through something that happened to you in your past. And the two parts of the brain are exactly the same. So it's very personal and very powerful. And when we're designing a garden for scent, we should use that. Just think, you know, what scents do we want? It's not enough just to say I want it to smell any more than I want it to look. You know, we don't plant plants just because we want color. We want to choose what color. How do we want it to work? How's it going to affect us? Do we want a smell that's going to invigorate us or to calm us down or to remind us of our childhood or the day that we got married or you know, a perfume or a meal or whatever? Designing scent can really dramatically affect your garden. So, A, include it as much as possible, and B, work on it. And also different times of day. So, for example, plants like tobacco plants only really smell in the evening. A lot of plants have oils which heat up during the day, then release their scent at night, particularly white ones, because that attracts pollinating insects at night on a warm day. So where are you going to be at night? You don't want those scents happening in a part of the garden you never go into in the evening. You want to be where you sit, and so on and so forth. So understanding that dramatically enriches one's experience of the garden. Taste is the other one that is clear. Is, you know, we grow food to nourish ourselves, but it's got to taste good. It's got to have real taste. And as any keen vegetable gardener will tell you only too willingly, no food tastes better than your own veg straight from the garden. And it, again, it's not enough just to say, oh, it's food. It's, you know, what are you eating? What does it actually taste of? What? Try and describe it. New potatoes from the garden taste much sweeter than any new potato you can buy, and that's because the sugars turn to starch very quickly. And so if you eat them within a few hours, they will be sweeter. And that's true of sweet corn, and it's true of asparagus and peas, which is why, incidentally, you know, peas tend to be frozen in the field. So that maximizing taste, and that those are the two obvious ones, but the other two senses, which I feel we don't really use enough, are sound, particularly plants like grasses. When the wind catches them, they rustle and shift. When you have the leaves I have hornbeam hedges in my garden, and at this time of year, just before they grow their new leaves, the old leaves are very dry and brittle. And when there's a slight wind, they patter. It sounds exactly like rain. And you hear this rain falling on a clear, bright day. And it's the leaves. It's a very particular sound. Frost has a sound when you walk it on the grass. Obviously, wind makes sound, but you can attract birds to your garden. Sound is really important. The sound of your footfall on a mossy, softer surface as opposed to a hard surface.
And the sound of running water as well.
Incredibly important. Really, really important. And the final one, which, again, we undervalue. I'm sure everybody's aware of it, but we don't value its importance, except for to people who are completely blind, is touch. You know, plant plants so that when you walk, you can trail your hand along and touch. And sometimes they'll have a scent. If you walk past a rosemary bush and run your hand down the length, you will release oils that will have, not only will you feel it, but you'll smell it. Other plants are very soft and feathery. Mm. If you have a box hedge, I've got a box hedge, and I like just to automatically, without thinking, I just brush my hand along the top of it as I pass. Touch, both on your hand, on your feet. Maybe you have a gap in the garden where you have to slightly push past very soft plants that aren't at all abrasive. This is all part of the language, the sensory language of your garden. And it doesn't matter whether you're sighted or not. To waste that opportunity, not to fully embrace it, is not to fully embrace the faculties that you have.
it doesn't matter whether you're fully sighted or totally blind or partially sighted or whatever, not to embrace all the possibilities of your senses. It's crazy. And people have this idea that, oh, if you're blind, then you need to develop your touch or your taste or whatever. I think that's just rubbish. I think we all do. You know, we all should use our senses to the maximum ability. And the best place to do that is in the garden. Just on your skin, you can feel a kind of air that hits you from different plants. Sometimes it's hot and bakes back. Sometimes it's cool. That's all important. It's all feeding in and the message. And some gardens that we love, actually, if you try to analyze it, we love it because it just feels nice. And that's about as articulate as you can get. I often walk around my own garden barefoot, silently. So just try and I would say to anybody is go into your garden and don't try and see, smell, hear or touch anything. Don't try and think anything. Just let it come to you. If you walk gently, let it come and all kinds of things start flooding in and coming to you. It's incredibly enriching but at the same time restful experience.
It is, and all of a sudden you've got no worries, you've got no troubles, and you think, well, I'll just sit here for a bit longer.
Yeah, exactly that. That's good.
Monty Doane and Kevin Smith, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, thank you.
Thank you very much.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
I'm delighted to be joined today by Frank Cottrell Boyce, who's come onto the show to tell us about the books of his life. What we normally start off with is a book that inspired you to become a writer when you first read it as a child or a young man.
Okay, well, I've got a good story about this. That would definitely be Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak, which I read when I was very little. I got it out of the library, and then I never saw it again for years. And this sounds crazy, but I thought I had dreamed that story. I never saw the book again and thought, well, I made that up. So I went round with this story in my head thinking, I've made this story up, and when I'm old enough, I'm going to write it and draw it, and I'm going to be really famous. And then when I was about 10, I saw another copy of it and thought, oh, right, I didn't dream that. That doesn't belong to me. But by then, I'd had a big opinion of myself because I'd spent years thinking I was a genius. So it completely made me that book, but not quite in the way that you might think. Genius book, it's like 10 sentences and it's just, well, it stays in your head. You know, that stays in my head without me seeing it all that time. And the monsters in that book are not like monsters in anything else. They're really, really different. And that's partly because he based them on his uncles, who would come around on a Saturday afternoon and eat themselves into a stupor and then say things like, we're going to eat you up. And those monsters are actually Maurice Sendak's uncle.
Fantastic. I never knew that. That's brilliant.
And when he came to the place where the wild things are, they roared their terrible roars and gnashed their terrible teeth and rolled their terrible eyes and showed their terrible claws. Till Max said, be still.
And a rainy day book that you'd curl up with on the sofa when you had nothing else to do.
Yeah, I think in the end that would be The Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin, because I first read that on a rainy day. I was off school sick and I read it tucked up in bed and the rain was pouring down outside, and it's an amazing book, and it's a book in which it's about magic. It's about a school for wizards, in fact. but there's something really strange about it. They kind of believe the magic in the book, which is a fantastic thing. And the hero is this great story, and it's just the perfect book, I think. And anywhere that I dip into that book, I'm happy.
A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin. The island of Gaunt, a single mountain that lifts its peak a mile above the storm-wrecked northeast sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports on its dark, narrow bays, many a Gauntishman has gone forth to serve the lords of the archipelago in their cities as wizard or mage, or looking for adventure, to wander working magic from isle to isle of all Earthsea. Of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both Dragon Lord and Archmage. His life is told of in The Deed of Ged and in many songs. But this is a tale of the time before his fame, before the songs were made.
I think I might have to take that as an educating read suggestion. I've never read it, and you're the second storyteller who's told me that, so I shall put that on my list of things to read. And finally, a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience.
I think it would be Landmarks by Robert McFarlane, which is about the English countryside, but in particular, it's about the words that we use to describe things. It's almost like a dictionary of words that are local words or lost words for things that you don't notice. And because you've got a word for it, you start to notice them. So it is a kind of magic. It is a kind of magic book because these words are like spells. So one word that's stuck in my head and I've used a lot since is smurs, which is the little tunnel that badgers make when they walk through the undergrowth and you can see where they've walked. So that's called a smurs.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Frank Cottrell Boyce, for sharing your love of reading with us and for coming onto the show today.
Thank you very much. It's been a real joy.
So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks again to all our guests and everyone who's been in touch about their book groups, the books you're enjoying, and your suggestion for books that would widen my horizons. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, you can find all our past shows, complete with exclusive author interviews and more, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.